I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, my colleagues and I unpack what's happening in a very complicated world. You'll hear from the New Yorker's award-winning reporters and thinkers, Jelani Cobb on race and justice, Jill Lepore on American history, Vincent Cunningham and Gia Tolentino on culture, Bill McKibben on climate change, and many more. To get the context behind events in the news, listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Israel and Hezbollah move closer to all-out war in Lebanon. We'll hear from people on both sides of the border. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also today at United Nations headquarters, President Joe Biden warned world leaders about the forces of division, extremism, and chaos.
Our test is to make sure that the forces holding us together are stronger than those who are pulling us apart.
Biden's foreign policy legacy.
And how a high-tech city in India is dealing with a water crisis.
I'm impatient because this climate change thing that is coming like a tsunami.
Plus, traveling south of the border with Americans seeking affordable medical care.
When it comes to health care, for me, there's no decision to make it. Mexico's the standard care.
All those stories and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us. Highways across Lebanon were choked with traffic again today as people tried to escape airstrikes by the Israeli military. Since Monday, the death toll in Lebanon has climbed to nearly 600 people, with many hundreds more injured.
Israel's military said it struck 1,500 targets across Lebanon, while Hezbollah fired dozens of rockets into northern Israel. We will hear from Israel in a few minutes. First, Ivo Friesen described to us what's happening in Lebanon today. He's with the United Nations High Commission for Refugees in Beirut.
We're talking about thousands of people who have additionally fled because, of course, this has been ongoing since October last year, but in smaller numbers. And we have seen a much larger wave in the past few days. So lots of panic, displacement from areas in the south to larger cities still in the south, but also from these areas further to the center of the country. And from the center of the country, actually, also to more northern areas, which for the moment are among the more safe locations to flee to.
And when these people reach where they're going, what kind of shelter are they finding? Are they mostly staying with family members, or are there shelters being set up?
It's a combination, and it depends first and foremost on financial capacity. If you have money, some people actually leave the country on the few remaining flights that are available or have done so already. Others can go to families, can rent temporarily an apartment. Those without these types of options and no financial means are depending on centrally organized arrangements, so-called collective centers, empty schools and other buildings that are being readied to receive internally displaced.
I've also read that some people are going to Syria, which of course itself is in a civil war. Do you know the numbers that are crossing the border there?
Not yet the precise numbers, but we are, of course, in close touch with our colleagues on the other side of the border. We're talking hundreds for the time being. I mean, until a few weeks ago, perhaps people could still think, well, this is happening elsewhere. And this is now much more a situation where nationwide everybody's extremely concerned, where previous trauma comes to the surface, and where we also all start to conclude this is now 1 year. So it has all kinds of accumulated impacts as well, economically and emotionally. And lots of other levels.
Speaking of those impacts, are hospitals and clinics able to keep up with the injuries from the Israeli strikes right now, especially, I would assume, in southern Lebanon?
We should not forget that, of course, last week the healthcare system was put under enormous pressure following the pager and exploding handheld devices campaign that occurred, and that was just settling down a little bit, and now this is happening. But there's also a lot of specific support being mounted. For example, our organization, UNHCR, is trying to bring in trauma kits to help the health authorities to provide emergency services.
I do want to ask you about the colleagues that you lost in Lebanon, the UNHCR colleagues. I understand two staff members have been killed. What can you tell us about what happened to them?
a very dear colleague, a hardworking colleague for many, many years doing community protection work in the Beka. Her residence was struck yesterday evening. She was found together with her child dead, so she did not make it. The other person was a contracted worker, a cleaner, but somebody who is walking around and helping us and working in our office on a daily basis.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you for your condolences.
You know, what does the future look like right now in the next days, weeks, maybe even months for people in Lebanon who have been facing so much for so long?
I think they follow the geopolitical developments and hope that something finally emerges out of these developments that is going to bring an end to the conflict in Gaza, because this is, of course, Gaza related. If that is not happening, and then unfortunately, I think we all realize we need to brace ourselves. And it can only lead to a situation where we need to continue to make clear as humanitarians what the impact is at the human level among civilians and combine it with a call for respect of international humanitarian law also in this conflict.
Ivo Friesen is the UNHCR's representative to Lebanon. He joined us from Beirut.
In northern Israel, a lot of people were evacuated from their homes months ago when cross-border attacks started to escalate. There are still Israelis living in the area, including Lior Shlef. He spoke to us from Sneer, a farming kibbutz right at the Lebanese border.
Sneer is a kibbutz which sits on the Lebanese border and on the origins of the Jordan. We are a farming kibbutz, which means we live on agriculture. We have avocado orchards and we have a cattle ranch and some chickens. On a normal day, there's 600 people here, from the youngest child to the oldest person. Today, you'll find here something, I would say, like 50 people. Like half of them is a part of the security team that protects the kibbutz. Mm. Which is very, it's very complicated because there's nothing here. Like there's no grocery shop, there's no medical aid. You know, if one of your tooth aches, it's a problem to find someone that will fix it. And it's not the most comfortable place to live, and there's a lot of noise. A lot of noise on a daily basis.
Yeah, given how close you are to the border, what can you actually see?
We can see the attacks over there. We can see the attacks over here. You can see, you know, the smoke running around for every place and a lot of bushfires. Definitely not the normal face of this area, which is, on a normal day, by far one of the most beautiful places there is to be.
Are you seeing drones and rockets coming from Hezbollah, and do you see the Israeli defense systems taking them out?
It's not always so easy to see them. They're usually flying very high, which makes them hard to see them. And if they're getting lower, then when you see them, it means it's coming towards you. But you see them every once in a while, yeah?
And if you see them coming towards you, I imagine you have to move pretty fast to get out of the way.
Well, we know what we're doing around here. We're very much prepared. And if we're going to sit somewhere, we're going to sit under a tree that a drone that will come above us won't see us. We know how to protect ourselves and understand that that's the reality these days. Hopefully it will end someday soon.
But do the civilians think this is an effective move that will get them back to those towns like Kiryat Shmona?
Definitely. This is, in the end of the day, unfortunately, it's not the first war we're going through. And there will be another war afterwards. The war, it's not a war. It will be a battle to help the civilians go back to their home. That will be a very hard and long battle. But eventually we will succeed.
This is precisely what is worrying for the international community. I mean, there are calls from around the globe to end the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah. What are you hoping to see next?
What I'm hoping to see next is very simple. Decision 1701, Hezbollah terrorist 10 kilometers from the border, and I'll be a happy camper.
That's a UN order of withdrawal from the border that Hezbollah agreed to, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And then we can go back safely to our home and build our communities. In the end of the day, we just want to have a good life over here. We don't want to fight with anyone throughout history. The Lebanese are not our enemies. The Hezbollah that entered Lebanon in 1982 completely destroyed the whole country, sucked the living life of their energy, take all of their money, and trying to convert them into a terror country. So the Lebanese are not our enemy. We're fighting a terror organization which is one of the worst in the world, which put missiles inside people's houses so we won't shoot them back, which is ruining the whole country. We just want to live a nice and peaceful life next to the origins of the Jordan and jump to the banyas with my kids and enjoy good and peaceful life.
That's Lior Schleff speaking with us from the Israeli community where he lives, right next to the Lebanon border. Follow more of our reporting on the Middle East online at theworld.org.
Imperial County, California is in the southeastern corner of the state, right next to Arizona and Mexico. It is one of the nation's most productive agricultural areas. It is also a place where asthma rates have soared for decades. Those two things go hand in hand in a part of California where medical specialists are scarce. As Philip Salata from iNews Source reports, residents there are looking south of the border for answers.
To get the health care he needs, Brian Vega says for him, there is only one choice. And it's not even in his home county, not even in the same country.
When it comes to health care, for me, there's no decision to make it. Mexico is the standard care to go.
Imperial County has long faced setbacks in delivering adequate health care. A dearth of specialists forced many patients to travel beyond county lines. It's a rural and largely agricultural region. But directly to its south lies Baja California's capital city, the boisterous urban metropolis of Mexicali. Rather than traveling hours to San Diego or Palm Springs, many residents look across the border for specialty care they can't find locally. And one specialty service that is as robust in Mexicali as it is scant in Imperial County is respiratory health care. Yet, it's a need prevalent on both sides of the border. And that's because of something that straddles both sides. It's the thick layer of pollution that plagues the region, explains Mexicali-based asthma specialist Dr. Valente Merida. It's a complex cocktail of toxins made up of dust from the degrading salt and sea, agricultural runoff, cross-border exhaust, and windstorms that froth pollutants into churning cloud trapped between adjacent mountains.
You have a lot of pollution here. It's the same pollution they have in Imperial Valley, in Coachella. They're looking for a lot of assistance. We have the same problems. We share the problems in that manner.
For decades, the region has earned a failing grade for air quality from the American Lung Association. In Imperial County, it's led to having the state's highest rate of children ending up in an emergency room to manage their asthma, which is a sign of poor asthma management and strained resources, researchers say. Gilberto Manzanares, a former Calexico City Council member, has had asthma since childhood. He moved to San Diego, where his asthma virtually disappeared, only to reappear upon return.
Almost immediately, I landed one of my bigger asthma episodes that I've had.
He struggled to find specialized care in Imperial County.
But in Mexico, there's actually clinics, like entire clinics that just specialize in asthma and respiratory issues.
Dr. Majid Mani, an Imperial Valley doctor and healthcare advocate, says that the few pulmonologists there are focus on providing intensive care.
But there is no asthma specialist.
Sounds okay. All right. Well, welcome to Hope of Philip.
When Brian Vega's lung collapsed the first time, he was in Los Angeles, far from his family home. He got COVID, then pneumonia. Then it collapsed. LA doctors reinflated it.
I was down for Mother's Day a couple of months after, and my lung collapsed again.
This time, doctors in Mexicali reinflated it.
And so for the next sort of 8 months, I stayed under the care of Mexican healthcare.
In Mexicali, the doctors set out to get to the root of the problem. And after many tests, they did. They said that Imperial Valley air was largely to blame for his 24-year-old lung folding under pressure twice. To Vega's surprise, the doctors didn't stop there. They even connected him with a therapist. The trips have since become not only a necessity, but a tradition, a way of both caring for himself and nursing his connection to his culture.
I don't know if it's just a standard of care or if it's a matter of culture, but what I know when I go to Mexicali to go get health care is that they care about me, and they care about me enough to really get to the root of different issues, regardless of how many specialists it will require.
And a trip to the doctor also means a haircut, a good meal, a stop off at the cathedral his grandmother would frequent.
You would be doing Mex a disservice if you only come for the thing that you need.
For The World, I'm Philip Salata, Mexicali, Mexico.
Phillips' reporting was supported by the California Fellowship at the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism.
Women who rule the Cuban music scene. That's just ahead on the show. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Two major weather systems to our south are dumping heavy rains and blowing powerful winds. Tropical Storm John hit Mexico's Pacific side late Monday. The U.S. National Hurricane Center has put out a warning for flash floods and mudslides. Meanwhile, Tropical Storm Helene is on the move in the Caribbean. The storm was passing by the western end of Cuba today as hurricane watches were issued there.
The next story we've got for you is from Cuba, but it is not about that weather at all. It's about a legendary Cuban musical ensemble that's been breaking barriers for more than three decades.
Camina la isla y pregunta quién llegó. Dime quién llegó. Dile a todo el mundo que Obini Bata soy yo.
Agua.
Obini Bata is an all-women ensemble performing traditional Afro-Cuban music. They've opened doors for many female musicians in Cuba, fighting discrimination and sexism, all by daring to play an instrument that women were once forbidden to touch. The World's Tibi Saizea has our story.
In the summer of 1993, a group of women that were part of the Cuban National Folklore Group decided to put together an all-female show to celebrate Father's Day.
Un grupo de bailarinas que se dispusieron el Día de los Padres.
Eva Despine remembers those days. She was one of the organizers of this show. And she says these women wanted to honor their male colleagues with dance and music.
Durante este tiempo, éramos bailarinas.
She says at that time, all women at the National Folklore Group were dancers. So for this show, they had to learn how to play instruments. And that included a drum that was particularly controversial.
Era primera vez que mujeres se atrevían a...
It was the first time that women dared to play the bata drums in a performance setting, Despine says. Before I tell you what happened next, let's understand what the bata drum is and why it's a big deal in Cuba.
Bata drums, originally back in Yoruba land, the region of West Africa where Nigeria is today, were talking drums. These were drums that could mimic the tones of the Yoruba language.
Susan Thomas is a musicologist at the University of Colorado Boulder and an expert on Cuban music. She says the bata drums were mostly used in religious ceremonies to communicate with gods. It's a double-headed drum shaped like an hourglass with one end larger than the other. They were introduced into Cuba by enslaved Africans in the 19th century and incorporated into rituals of Santeria, a widely practiced religion in Cuba.
The drums are believed to house a spirit, Anya. And it's believed in Cuba that a person touching or playing the drum who is out of balance with the power of Anya can cause problems.
Tradition dictates that the sacred bata drums are to be played only by men.
Because women menstruate, the menstrual blood might be mistaken by Anya as sacrificial blood, and that having women touch or play the drums could therefore put the drum and the drum's function in danger.
Eva Despine says she and the other females of the group knew about these religious beliefs when they decided to play the bata drums, but she says they were playing in an artistic setting, not a religious one. After that initial success, they were very excited to continue playing the drums, so they created the group Obini Bata, or Women Bata, in Yoruba language.
Camina la isla y pregunta quién llegó.
Dime quién llegó.
Not everyone was happy about it, though.
No pusieron muchas trabas al inicio.
We faced a lot of obstacles, she tells me. Sometimes we arrived at the rehearsal place and it was closed and the keys were lost. Other days we couldn't find the drums, they were hidden. Male instructors were warned that if they taught women, it could cost them a place in a traveling tour or a major performance.
These conceptions about who is allowed to play a drum, who is allowed to come into contact with it, and why, doesn't stay in the religious sphere, right? It bleeds into the roles that are typically assigned to men and women.
Niurka Marquez is an artist and a scholar at the Department of Religious Studies at Florida International University.
Within music and the arts, I think we see a predominance of women as dancers, as singers, but we don't see a large number of established instrumentalists.
Especially percussionists. Even so, the women of Obini Bata persisted and the group gained popularity. Today, they've toured the world multiple times and trained dozens of women on how to play Afro-Cuban drums. Over the years, doors slowly began opening for female drummers in Cuba. Just as women gradually took on roles in politics, academics, and other areas of Cuban society, Miurka Marquez says Obini Bata provided a much-needed representation.
Now the company has 30 years of existence, right? So you have an entire generation that have grown up seeing other women play the drums, providing representation for young women who are interested in pursuing percussion as a career, right? And are interested in forwarding this culture.
Mulata linda, de ojos saltones, lleva vestido.
Brenda Navarrete is one of Cuba's great young talents and an international rising star. She's a percussionist who has played with renowned musicians in Cuba and abroad, and her career started playing drums with Obini Bata.
Y al conectar con los tambores Bata, empezó un nuevo mundo para mí.
Obini Bata opened a new world for me, she says. It gave me a different perspective about drums and women. She says a common compliment she gets as a percussionist is, you play as strong as a man. But she says women offer a lot more than strength when playing drums.
Nosotros somos más sensuales a la hora de tocar.
Our touch is more sensual, sweet, mellow. But it doesn't mean it's not strong, she says. Today, the island is seeing more women percussionists, but Professor Susan Thomas says there's still a lot more work to do.
I wish I could say that these leading women artists had blown up the barriers for other women and that there's been a flood of women musicians after them, but I can't.
She says the percussion scene in Cuba remains dominated by men. But after Obini Bata, Cubans have finally accepted that women can also drum. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
That story from TB first aired last summer. We've got a lot more global news ahead for you this hour. You're listening to The World.
There's art that's all about fun and entertainment, and then there's the kind of art created by exiles from a repressive dictatorship.
Which is so much about their lives and the continuation and the sustainability of themselves as human beings in this world. It's awe-inspiring.
The Belarus Free Theater, that story's ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Hurricane Daniel hit Libya's coastal city of Derna 1 year ago. It unleashed a torrent of water after two dams overfilled with rainwater and burst. Officials estimate that 6,000 people were killed, but many Libyans will tell you that the death toll was twice that. Thousands of people are still missing in what turned out to be one of the worst climate-related disasters of 2023. As the world's Duri Biscarin reports, the story of what played out in Derna highlights the dangers of not taking climate change seriously.
26-year-old Sanad Alwami is the kind of guy who just wants to help people.
Okay, Sanad Alwami.
He's an activist, he works for local groups, and he's a volunteer for the Libyan Red Crescent in Derna, his hometown in eastern Libya. Translating our conversation is Arwa Faroun, a Libyan journalist who traveled to Derna. Together, we ask Alwami about how the local branch of the Red Crescent prepared when they saw Storm Daniel coming last year.
We are not used to such a big natural disaster. We only worked and trained for war and conflicts.
Last year, Alwami says he was at the Red Crescent offices watching the storm come in. He says they looked at maps and thought the biggest risk would come from the sea. So they started evacuating people on the waterfront. But the two dams that sat above the city collapsing, Alwami says no one, not the military, not the police, not him, realized how real of a possibility that was. It was the kind of thing people created commissions to study, held conferences about.
There's academic studies and research that warns about the dam, that the system is very poor and it might collapse, but mostly people didn't believe in this research and studies.
On the night of the disaster, authorities in eastern Libya evacuated people inland and enforced a curfew to keep the streets clear for emergency personnel. Armed security patrolled the streets. To Alwami, this was the critical mistake.
The official, they should take out all the people with force instead of leaving them dying inside their houses that night.
Storm Daniel pounded Libya with rain. The dams burst around 3 a.m. In this video published by Al Arabiya, a Qatar-based news channel, a resident of Derna records a torrent of water outside as everyone in his apartment building climbs up onto the roof. Sanad Alwami and his team went out to rescue survivors.
We said and we agreed about you will only help the people who needs help. Like, we will not deal with dead bodies. But when we went outside, they find out that they are the only people who were alive.
The Libyan government says more than 6,000 people died in the floods. Experts say it's likely twice that.
There's a clear lack of monitoring capacities and also taking climate change seriously.
Malak Altaib is an independent researcher based in Paris who wrote about Derna for the Middle East Institute. She says the Derna dam collapses show the difference between acknowledging climate change in a theoretical sense and preparing a city for the weather patterns that are now possible.
It's on a bigger level, and here we're talking about a phenomenon that is now causing extreme weather events in regions that are not used to that.
One analysis released by the World Weather Attribution Project found that global human-induced climate change made a storm like Daniel 50 times more likely. About 16 inches of rain fell in 24 hours. Pair that with aging infrastructure and a city that's recently emerged from a civil war, and you have a recipe for disaster.
Really, climate change is kind of the Achilles heel.
Josh Clem is an executive director at International Rivers, an advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. As average temperatures rise, he says, we see more extreme rainfall. We also see more periods of extreme drought, and these weather patterns are hitting aging dams.
The time that the Derna dams were built in the 1970s was really the heyday of dam construction.
Globally, about 1,000 large dams a year were built in the 1970s, including the dams in Derna. Most have a shelf life of about 50 years, and that means they're hitting their expiration dates now, like right now.
Decision makers have kind of kicked the can down the road when it comes to making decisions about what to do with this increasingly risky and aging fleet of dams. But unfortunately, that bill is kind of coming due now.
Over the summer, a court in eastern Libya sentenced 12 officials who had been involved in managing the dams on charges including negligence, premeditated murder, and wasting public money. For some residents, that's enough. But Sanad Alwami, the Red Crescent volunteer, fears the country won't be ready for another big disaster.
If another natural disaster will happen in Libya ever again, the same scenario will happen, he thinks.
For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin.
In the Indian megacity of Bangalore, official name Bengaluru, ads for luxury apartments woo prospective residents with the promise of abundant water. That's because the city saw a water emergency earlier this year. Residents were asked to work from home and cut back on their water use. There is a sense now in the city that a bigger crisis was narrowly averted, but people are still worried about shortages. Reporter Sushmita Pathak recently spent a day in Bengaluru, where one forgotten source of water is being rediscovered.
On a quiet lane near Bengaluru's airport, coconut palms sway in the light afternoon breeze. I'm here with urban planner and Bengaluru resident Vishwanath Srikantaya. He's a water activist and he's showing me around a community dealing with water shortages. Almost every home has a blue cylindrical drum around 4 feet tall outside the front gate.
This area gets water once in 4 days for about an hour.
Just an hour.
And people have to stock up water, as you can see in these drums.
What he really wants to show me is a 50-year-old well. When Vishwanath first came across the well a few years ago, it was full of garbage. Now it has artwork on the side and a pulley for residents to draw water for washing or bathing.
Even during the crisis, when there was no water in the city, this well always had water.
Small, shallow wells like this can play a big role in solving Bengaluru's water problem. The city gets most of its water from the Kaveri River, about 60 miles away. But newer parts of the city, like the one Vishwanath and I are driving through, don't have municipal water connections yet.
The infrastructure is barely able to match the city's growth. And so when the pipe network does not reach, the dependency is completely on groundwater.
This groundwater is pumped up from great depths through bore wells. Those are narrow wells that go much farther down than traditional wells. Bengaluru has an indiscriminate number of them. And new bore wells are being drilled all the time.
And what happens is when you go deeper into the ground, the water becomes more saline, more unreliable, and the bore wells tend to dry out.
That's exactly what happened this year. Many of the city's bore wells ran dry. But open wells, like the one I visited, tap into the shallow aquifer. This part of the earth, less than 100 feet below the ground, is like a sponge, says Vishwanath.
It can hold water and release water, right? Provided we understand the recharge zones and make sure that rainwater percolates into these recharge zones.
For centuries, Indians depended on shallow aquifers. Open wells were common. But with the advent of deep drilling technology, traditional wells fell out of use. Now, Vishwanath is at the forefront of efforts to bring back the humble well.
Truly, it's a low, shallow hanging fruit.
Vishwanath is with Bioenvironmental Trust. The well he took me to see is one of a million that the organization hopes to revive. Vishwanath estimates they've cleaned and reactivated around 280,000 wells so far. Taking water from a well requires much less energy because you're only drawing it up 20 or 30 feet.
So it's very energy efficient. It's cheap water. It has very less carbon emissions.
The initiative also provides livelihoods to traditional well diggers. Sahana Goswami, an urban planner with the World Resources Institute in Bengaluru, is fascinated by the project.
This sort of campaign like Million Wells is very important because you are widening our scope and saying, here's another resource that we can tap into when we need.
Relying too much on one source of water is at the root of Bengaluru's water problems, after all.
We should have a diverse set of sources of water so that if one is diminished, you still have the other one that you can draw from.
And it's all the more urgent because of climate change. Summers in Bengaluru are becoming hotter and rainfall is becoming more erratic. At the same time, the city is urbanizing rapidly.
The way we have developed, we have all these paved surfaces. The natural capacity of water to get absorbed into the ground is also getting diminished. We have had more incidences of acute rainfall, but you know, short duration high rainfall, which usually flows away. So how much water has been absorbed into the ground has been a bit lesser.
Capturing rainwater is essential to recharge the shallow aquifer. Lakes do that naturally, and Bengaluru has a lot of them. The last well I visit with Vishwanath is next to one such lake near a 16th century fort. Just before sunset, ducks are swimming in the water. We even spot a kingfisher. But a couple of years ago, this lake was dry. The well was a dumping ground and was about to be closed by the municipality.
But then the lake got rehabilitated, got treated wastewater, and we saw that the earth filtered it and brought it here.
another environmental group filled the lake with rainwater and treated wastewater. Soon, the well filled up too. In the evening light, the pattern of the mesh cover over the well reflects beautifully on the water surface. A treatment plant next to the lake purifies water from the shallow aquifer. The treated water will soon be supplied directly to residents like Manjula. When the lake was dry, it was a very difficult time, she says. Many lakes in Bengaluru are set to be replenished, and efforts to rejuvenate shallow aquifers are now going on in 10 Indian cities. Vishwanath is happy, but also a bit impatient.
I'm impatient for the quicker replication because this climate change thing that is coming like a tsunami, right? So we don't have time to be able to deal with it. So that's the impatience that I feel, as much as the satisfaction.
For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak, Bengaluru, India.
In their home country, they were banned, but they are now known globally. The members of the Belarus Free Theater have performed in more than 40 different countries. They are not shy about taking aim at the repressive government back home in Minsk. The Belarus Free Theater's newest piece is about a star Olympic basketball player turned dissident. It opens tonight in New York. Jeff London reports.
From its very beginning, almost 20 years ago, the members of Belarus Free Theater had to do their work in secret because of the repressive Lukashenko regime. Natalia Kalyada, a co-founder of the company, says they chose to do a play called Psychosis 448, and they couldn't rent a performance space. She says venues told her.
In this particular show, you talk about sexual minorities, about mental issues, about suicide. They said we don't have such issues in Belarus.
Which, of course, was a lie.
Belarus is among top three countries on suicide, on domestic violence, on divorces. LGBTQI plus completely banned, hate crimes happening.
Kalyada had worked for the American Embassy in Minsk, and her husband and co-artistic director Nikolai Kalezin was an editor who had his newspaper shut down. They came up with various ruses to present their work under the radar. One way was to disguise a performance as a wedding reception.
Nikolai was performing Father of a Bride. Our actors will perform a bride, actor, a groom. We will be going to villages, like into the forest, stopping in every single village, drinking with locals, pretending it's a wedding, then bringing the whole audience of 200 people or 300 people, putting as a wedding and doing shows.
In those pre-smartphone days, to find an audience, they put up flyers in public restrooms. The company began doing their own plays, often based on verbatim interviews and current events. And even after Kalyada and Kalezin had to flee Belarus in 2011, they still communicated with the rest of the company via Skype, which put their shows on in garages and apartments. It was about that time that Belarus Free Theater started performing at La Mama in New York. Mia Yu is La Mama's artistic director.
There is the art that we create and is so valid and significant that is for entertainment or for bringing, you know, joy into our lives. But then there is this art that Belarus Free Theater creates, which is so much about their lives and the continuation and the sustainability of themselves as human beings in this world. It's awe-inspiring.
Although the entire company now lives in exile after Alexander Lukashenko's disputed election win in 2020, they're still dedicated to telling Belarusian stories. The new show, KS6 Small Forward, is about Katya Snistina's journey from basketball legend — she was on Belarus's Olympic women's team in 2008, to an outspoken critic of the regime and an out lesbian. And she stars in the show.
I'm just trying to find a way for myself how to help my country, you know, and this is a great way to help my country, because inside of the country people can't speak out loud anymore. So it became my job, it's our job to do it, to tell the world our story and keep fighting the way how we can.
Nikolai Kalesin pieced together the script from interviews with Snestina. Natalia Kaliada says they had one goal in putting the show together.
Katya is a basketball player. She is not a dancer. She is not a performer. And we want Katya to be Katya.
The show features music by DJ Blanca Barbara, a lot of movement with lots of basketballs, and Katya Snestina speaks in sports metaphors.
Each of us has many challenges when we need to keep faith in victory. The main victory is over ourselves, our silence, and our fears. And the main trophy is freedom.
Snestina, like all the members of Belarus Free Theater, misses her native land and her family. But she says she doesn't want President Lukashenko to stop her from enjoying her life. She wants to hold her wife's hand and be happy, even as she fights the power from thousands of miles away.
You need to stay strong, support people around you, like be healthy, be stable mentally, physically, and everything, to live longer than all these dictators, at least. That's my minimum plan.
KS6 Small Forward by Belarus Free Theater will not only be playing in New York for a month, the show will be available for streaming in Belarus. For The World, I'm Jeff London, New York.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. World leaders are in New York this week for the United Nations General Assembly. President Biden was at the podium this morning for his final address to that audience as president. Biden ran through a laundry list of his administration's foreign policy initiatives, but he also called on the international community to stick together and support one another during a time of serious global upheaval.
There'll always be forces that pull our countries apart and the world apart. Aggression, extremism, chaos, and cynicism. A desire to retreat from the world and go it alone. Our test, is to make sure that the forces holding us together are stronger than those that are pulling us apart.
The president has four more months in office, but we wanted to explore whether there has been a definable Biden doctrine on U.S. foreign policy. Richard Haass is a veteran American diplomat and president emeritus at the Council on Foreign Relations. We reached him in New York. Richard, what stood out to you from President Biden's speech today at the U.N.?
I thought what President Biden delivered was a good articulation of what you might call traditional American foreign policy. The framing you just played, that at any time in history, there's forces that bring the world together that are promoting order. At the same time, they're competing with forces that are tearing the world apart, promoting disorder or disarray. That's exactly right. And what the president essentially did was make the case for the United States working with other countries to tip the balance on the scales in favor of order, of bringing things together, whether it's to deal with regional challenges or global challenges or reining in new technologies or what have you. So I thought it was a classic statement of really post-World War II American foreign policy.
Was there anything that he didn't mention that struck you as missing from this speech?
It wasn't so much that he didn't mention it, is that there was no way he could reassure people in the room or beyond that the United States would be willing and able to play the kind of role it has played now for three quarters of a century. He couldn't reassure them going forward that that would remain the case. And that's in part because of Donald Trump and the election. But even beyond that, where Congress is, where the American people are, there's not a consensus about how large an international effort we ought to be making, much less the direction of that effort. And I think that's what's different. But there's no way the president can credibly reassure.
It's also a complex foreign policy landscape right now. Biden was candid about the major conflicts that are raging around the globe, from Ukraine to Sudan to Gaza and now Lebanon. When you look back over the past 4 years, is there a through line in the way that the Biden administration has responded to these events in particular?
I would argue the biggest through line, though it doesn't quite apply to all the events you mentioned, but it does apply to Ukraine and the response to Russian aggression, is an alliance-first foreign policy. And that is characterized U.S. policy towards, again, Europe and the war, pulling together NATO, what's still called the West, and to some extent working with Japan and others to try to deter potential Chinese aggression in the Asia Pacific. You know, we've worked closely with Japan, with South Korea, Taiwan, Australia, to some extent India. So I think that's been the centerpiece of the Biden foreign policy, less so in the Middle East, where the United States has a relationship with Israel and a degree of support for Israel that others are not comfortable with, and less so in places like Sudan and so forth, where nobody really has much of a policy to offer.
Right. You say this is an alliance-first foreign policy. Has there been any change to the way that Biden has changed his approach to Israel during his 4 years as president? I mean, the war in Gaza and now the expanding war with Hezbollah in Lebanon has put a lot of pressure on Biden for his support of Israel.
It has. And I would say the president has come up with a middle ground that's failed and hasn't made anybody happy. It's been relatively supportive of Israel, except for some verbal criticism, one or two votes in the UN, one time holding off the delivery of some large bombs. But it has been way too supportive of Israel for many people in the Middle East, those Americans who have connections or sympathies for Palestinians and Arabs more broadly, and for those supporters of Israel, you know, the more ardent supporters in the United States, and for many Israelis, those who support this Israeli government, the president hasn't been sufficiently supportive. The fact that he's introduced criticism and the like has been unwelcome.
Do you see Biden's presidency and his policy toward Israel, the U.S.-Israel alliance, as perhaps the end of an era?
It's a really interesting question. I believe Joe Biden is the last American president who came of age, was of a generation where his instinctive position, his default position, was support for Israel. He largely saw Israel still through the eyes of someone after World War II, coming out of the Holocaust, the foundation of Israel in the 40s. Even in his first decades, Israel was David to the Goliath of the Arab world. I think later generations in the United States see Israel more as a Goliath to David, more as at times on the left, oppressor rather than oppressed, much less sympathy, much less instinctive support. So I think going forward, American presidents are more likely to be more conditional in their support of Israel than Joe Biden.
Long before becoming president, Biden spent, you know, a whole career in foreign relations, making personal relationships with leaders of other countries. Has his presidency lived up to the expectations that might have been set about his abilities in foreign affairs because of that experience?
My own view is that he entered the office with decades and decades of experience. He understood the issues, particularly in Europe. I think that was his strength. And I think there it's helped with Ukraine. It's helped with managing allied relations. I don't think it's helped so much out in Asia. I don't think it's helped so much in the Middle East. I don't think it's helped so much in terms of explaining to the American people why what we're doing is in their collective interest. But yes, I think your basic point is right and fair, that Joe Biden entered this job essentially with a mindset that he wanted to continue for the United States to play a large role in the world, to, among other things, discourage aggression, to discourage the acquisition of territory by force. I think he has an instinctive belief in American leadership, not unilateralism, but leadership. He rejects isolationism. And the problem for Joe Biden is that while he stands for all those things, and I happen to agree with him, don't get me wrong, he was president at a time where the country was moving away from those things, and at a time when the rest of the world wasn't cooperating, particularly Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and others. So the real question going forward is whether Joe Biden will be the last president, if you will, of the post-World War II era, having essentially presided over the end of a 75-year experiment with American leadership, or whether he will offer continuity. And that's where the outcome of our elections matters so much, whether it's Donald Trump or Kamala Harris. Ultimately, Biden's legacy will be affected by what happens this November.
Richard Haass led the Council on Foreign Relations from 2003 to 2023. He is the author of the Substack newsletter, Home and Away.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.